The headlines this hour. Iran says the interim government that the Taliban have announced in Afghanistan is not an inclusive one. Syrian government forces enter an area held by militants in the southern province of Deraa after 10 years under a surrender deal. And Lebanon's new Prime Minister Najib Mikati says that he has no magic wand to fix his country's economic crisis. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran's foreign ministry says the interim government that the Taliban have announced in Afghanistan is not inclusive.
What has been touted as the interim Afghan government is certainly not the inclusive government that the international community and the Islamic Republic of Iran expected. We really have to wait and see how the Taliban respond to international demands.
Sayed Khatibzadeh noted that a broad-based government can bring peace and stability to Afghanistan. He called for dialogue to resolve the ongoing crisis in the Asian country. Khatibzadeh said that Iran will decide on the invitation to attend the inauguration of the new Afghan government based on the Taliban's actions. On Tuesday, the group announced an interim cabinet made up entirely of men and dominated by its veteran members. This came 3 weeks after the Taliban seized control of the Afghan capital. The trial of five alleged 9/11 attackers, which started last week in the military commission's court at the U.S. Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. The suspects face the death penalty if convicted. 20 years after the terrorist attacks in the U.S., the trial still remains bogged down in its process.
Alleged September 11th mastermind Khaled Sheikh Mohammed and four others appeared in a military courtroom at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic began. 20 years after the attacks, the U.S. military is still in the pretrial phase of persecution of the suspects. The five are accused of war crimes in the 9/11 attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people 2 decades ago. If found guilty, they face execution. Meanwhile, human rights advocates say the trial is full of legal obstacles and it may never reach a satisfactory conclusion. The defense attorneys have tried to challenge the military commission's legitimacy to overturn the case by arguing that the CIA tortured the detainees in a secret prison before transferring them to Guantanamo. The defendants' lawyers accused the U.S. government of bringing the five suspects to Guantanamo Bay to continue covering up torture. They said the government's secrecy about the use of torture is the main reason that indefinite detention still exists at Guantanamo Bay. Since its establishment, the notorious prison has been under fire for the so-called enhanced interrogation methods used on inmates to force them to confess to crimes they might not even have committed. Interrogation methods which international human rights advocates say amounted to torture.
Primarily because it's designed to be an institution through which the U.S. Subverts the law, through which the U.S. Is able to commit torture, is able essentially to go beyond what is usually permissible. So questions such as the one that you posed, while it is relevant in an ordinary set of circumstances, in an ordinary concept of the rule of law, the blunt answer is the rule of law and judicial process and the implementation of any judicial process for the U.S. at least, is irrelevant when it comes to Guantanamo Bay, or at least not a priority.
Experts say at the rate the case is proceeding, there could be another decade of procedural hearings.
The Syrian army has entered Al-Yadudeh township in the country's southern province of Deraa after 10 years. The army reportedly entered the area with Russian troops. Local media say the entry followed a Russian-brokered surrender deal with militants that came into effect on September the 1st. The deal allowed the army to take control of strategic Deraa al-Balad and gave residents an opportunity to return to their homes. Under the agreement, the militants must either leave the area or surrender their firearms if they choose to remain. Russia mediated the deal after weeks of tensions between the army and the militants. Deraa al-Balad was the last stronghold of the militants in southern Syria. Lebanon's new prime minister says that he has, quote, no magic wand to rescue the country from one of its worst ever economic crises. Najib Mikati said that there is no easy solution to the situation and that it takes determination and a plan to achieve the hopes of the population. He pledged that his newly formed cabinet will work hard to resolve shortages of fuel and medicine. Mikati, who took the office last week, made the remarks in the first cabinet meeting held at the Lebanese presidential palace. The premier has promised to revive talks with the International Monetary Fund, which experts say is key to rescuing Lebanon. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency describes as constructive his recent visit to Iran, where they reached an agreement on the agency's monitoring activities.
We had a very constructive trip to Tehran, and there is an agreement that we have now on important matters relating to the equipment and the continuity of knowledge that we will be establishing through it.
Rafael Grossi said that he will go back to Tehran soon for high-level talks with the new Iranian government. Grossi has asked Iran to fulfill what he called the country's additional commitments to the IAEA. Tehran says the obligations are relevant under the 2015 nuclear deal, only if the other signatories do their share and lift anti-Iran sanctions. Meanwhile, head of Iran's nuclear body, Mohammad Eslami, criticized the IAEA for its failure to adhere to its duties under its own regulations. Eslami said the agency should help all member states in their peaceful nuclear activities. But he said the agency has offered no help to Iran. Vienna correspondent Homolesky says with the new agreement between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the overall atmosphere seems to be in favor of Tehran.
In this board session, the agency issued two reports on Iran, and in those reports, there were two issues that he raised concerns about. One of them was the issue of access to monitoring equipment in Iran, which was, as you well know, resolved with his visit to the country. So because that issue has now been, in practical terms, resolved, and the agency now believes it has the necessary information that it needs, although it does not have access to it, but that data is being recorded and will stay under seal, under IAEA and the Iranian seals, until the JCPOA is revived. This is, in the view of the IAEA, a successful arrangement, and that's why Mr. Grossi said that his trip to Iran was a very constructive one. So overall, with this achievement that was made in Iran, I would say that things are looking in favor of the Islamic Republic now, and probably there won't be any talk of the adoption of a resolution, although, as I say, the Iran issue is on the agenda. Discussions on Iran haven't started yet, but it looks like with this additional information that the agency gave to the board today, things are looking in favor of the country.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have protested in support of six Palestinians who escaped a high-security Israeli jail last week. The protesters gathered in front of the Red Cross building in Gaza City. Some of them were wearing handcuffs in show of solidarity with the Palestinian prisoners. Israel has been conducting a massive manhunt since last Monday, when the six inmates tunneled out of the regime's Gilboa prison. Four of them have been rearrested. Earlier today, Israeli warplanes once again pounded the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the strikes are an attempt by the regime to divert attention from the successful escape of the Palestinian prisoners. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon joined us earlier with more details on the protests held in Gaza City in support of the Palestinian prisoners.
During the protest, people there shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded protection for all Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, and also especially those who were recaptured by Israeli forces. In front of the ICRC itself, Hamas senior official Mushir al-Masri warned the Israeli regime against harming those prisoners who were recaptured, and also reiterated the statement made by Abu Ubaida, the spokesman of Hamas's military wing, the Izdin Qassam Brigades, who said that the six escapees will be the first one on the list of any future prisoner swap deal with the Israeli regime. Those four prisoners who were recaptured by the Israeli forces, were heavily interrogated and tortured, as we can see from the images released upon their capture.
Iran has slammed the West for what it calls shameful double standards in dealing with nuclear-armed Israel. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guest. Let's take a listen.
Now, Iran has slammed the West for what it calls shameful double standard in dealing with nuclear-armed Israel. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that the West has not only failed to put pressure on Israel to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it also fully supported the regime. The official noted that Iran would continue to push for the disarmament of Israel and a nuke-free West Asia. The spokesman said that Israel, that's believed to be in possession of hundreds of nukes, is in no position to lecture NPT member states like Iran. Last week, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid accused Iran of marching toward a nuclear weapon. Lapid said that Israel will act if the world fails to stop Iran. Okay, now time to get some insight and see what other things about this. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have Mick Napier with the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. Also, Mimi Alham, journalist and writer with Al Mayed in English, will join us from Perth. So, Mick, is this a joke or what? Israel will stop Iran if the world fails to do that? What are they talking about? Iran, everybody knows about Iran's missile activity. 15 IAEA reports confirm that the nuclear program Iran is pursuing is peaceful, is not diverted toward military purposes. So what's Tel Aviv talking about?
Well, you use the word joke, but it's certainly a very sick joke. Let's look at the basic record, which is open, and anyone can check this. France and the UK helped Israel to develop its secret nuclear capability. I can't remember, it was France or Britain supplied the heavy water, but all the technology that reached Israel didn't come from the USA at that time, it came from Europe. But Israel is now determined to preserve its monopoly of nuclear weapons in West Asia. And that monopoly is very important to Israel. Look, it was openly discussed in the Israeli press that when Israel was losing the war in the early stages against Egypt in 73, Moshe Dayan pressed the defense minister, pressed the prime minister to use nuclear weapons against Egypt. Now, she at that time said no, but the threat to use nuclear weapons was used as a threat to America, to force America to massively increase its sales weapons to Israel during that crisis, during that war. And therefore, the use of nuclear the value of nuclear weapons is not just in their use, it's in the threat to use them. And Israel's the only country in the Middle East and West Asia which has them, but which has also threatened to use them. Look, 2 years after that, and here's another argument why Israel cannot be trusted with nuclear weapons. I don't think Israel should be trusted with very much. But 2 years after 73, because the apartheid regime in South Africa later fell, we see the documents. And Shimon Peres was offering to sell nuclear weapons to the apartheid regime in South Africa. It seems like a comedy script. But he said, we can give them in two sizes. And these documents are in the public domain at the moment. 10 years later, Israel bombed Iraq. You don't have to be a fan of Saddam Hussein to pay attention to this. Because when the Israelis bombed the Iraqi reactor, the Israeli prime minister at the time, Begin, he said, every Israeli government will act in a similar way whenever they suspect, as in can claim, that any of their neighbors are a nuclear threat to Israel. Shortly after that, Mordechai Vanunu, a humble engineer in Israel's nuclear plant, gave his story for free to the Western press, proving that Israel had not just atom bombs, but hydrogen bombs. He was kidnapped, injected from Rome, taken to Israel, and almost 40 years later, he's still detained in Israel. For revealing the extent of Israel's nuclear weapons.
Exactly, yeah. And I want to put that question to Mimi Alham, the U.S., U.K., France, and others. They are stopping this. Nukes are threats to everyone.
It doesn't matter if you're a Jew, Muslim, or whatever. Nukes are nukes, right? So nukes, if Iran pursues it with other countries, it's a threat. If Israel doesn't pursue it, it's not a threat?
Well, it's interesting. I believe a couple of years ago, the Russians came out with a report saying that Israel has 80 to 100 nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. And clearly, like, this number of bombs could annihilate an entire country. And once they go flying into the air, of course, that means that everyone's going to notice. This is the doctrine, mutually assured destruction, the belief that once someone uses nukes, it's possible everyone's going to start using nukes. And so this has, of course, a nightmarish scenario associated with it. The problem is that the nukes already exist. The United States, the UK, Russia already have them, of course, France and China and India and Pakistan as well. And illegally, Israel acquired them. This is already, they don't admit it, but Vanunu himself was a nuclear scientist who exposed this. Of course, the Israelis put him in jail for that. So given that Israel is not prepared to give up its nukes, and it's prepared to point the finger at other countries accusing them of nukes and making threats about nukes, I think it is actually in Iran's interest, and perhaps in the interest to stability in the region, to get nuclear weapons.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh, and also Mimi Alaham, journalist and writer with Al Mayadeen English, joined us from Perth with their contribution. And that's all for this edition of the News Review.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Activists on the ground fear public concern for the disaster-struck region in Louisiana is already waning, leaving people in a state hit hard by the COVID pandemic, vulnerable to widespread hunger and houselessness. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "It's Not Just a Loss of Electricity. Ida Left People Houseless and Jobless." Stay tuned for more. In Louisiana, residents and advocates were already bracing for a wave of hardship and home evictions across an economically vulnerable region when Hurricane Ida slammed into southeastern Louisiana recently, destroying homes and businesses and displacing tens of thousands of people during a COVID surge. The storm left entire communities without power and clean water for over a week and countless workers without a paycheck as rents came due and federal pandemic supports dissipated. For Louisianans in Hurricane Ida's path, the last-minute decision to evacuate their homes or shelter in place for the deadly storm was only the beginning. After the storm passed, came days of sweltering heat without power, the scramble to put tarps on leaking roofs, the days of waiting for the phone and internet service needed to apply for federal disaster relief that many still have not received. For those who evacuated, the cost of living on the road piled up alongside the anxiety of deciding when to return to disrupted lives and damaged homes. Activists on the ground fear public concern for the disaster-struck region is already waning, leaving people in a state hit hard by the COVID pandemic, vulnerable to widespread hunger and houselessness. National attention quickly moved to the East Coast as Ida dumped heavy rains and caused widespread flooding in New York and New Jersey that left dozens of people dead. In the lower-lying and coastal parishes that took the brunt of the storm, the recovery could take years, according to August Krepel, Principal Chief of the United Huma Nation. At least 11,000 of the Huma tribe's 19,000 members living across the five parishes hit hardest by the storm have been affected. Krepel, a firefighter who worked day and night over the past 2 weeks providing disaster relief, said the United Huma Nation has spent decades fighting for federal tribal recognition and the enhanced support and disaster relief that comes with it. Back in New Orleans, organizers fear a wave of evictions will erupt after an order from the state's Democratic governor pausing legal proceeding expires on September 24th, further displacing people who survived the storm or attempt to return after evacuating. Many people in the Crescent City and across southeast Louisiana work low-wage jobs in the service, tourism, and retail industries and could be without work or a paycheck for weeks. Louisiana cut off pandemic unemployment benefits in late July, and the Supreme Court struck down an already weak federal moratorium on evictions just days before the storm. Less than 14% of the $248 million in federal emergency assistance for home renters in Louisiana has been distributed so far, compared to 67% in Texas and 100% in New York, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Recently, the New Orleans Renters' Rights Assembly released a list of demands calling on the city to keep its eviction court closed until all the federal rental assistance is distributed and at least until the end of the year. The tenants' union said an additional $500 million in rental assistance is needed across the state. Last summer, protesters blocked and shut down the city's eviction court after local and state moratoriums on evictions expired, an action that made national headlines and put pressure on federal policymakers to implement a national eviction moratorium. Activists say the rental assistance program, which is administered by the state in rural areas and by city officials in New Orleans, is in need of an overhaul. Instead of requiring renters to produce onerous amounts of documentation and making relief payments to landlords, housing justice activists in New Orleans and beyond say people who fell behind on rent during pandemic lockdowns should receive assistance in cash, a model that has already proven successful in other communities. The tenants' union say the city must also provide a dedicated multilingual staff to help people with disabilities apply for rental assistance and disaster relief. The tenants' union is also demanding the right to return for all residents displaced by the storm, including renters who live in damaged homes. Even if legal evictions are temporarily halted, organizers fear the landlords will neglect badly needed repairs, forcing people to either live in uninhabitable homes or go someplace else. Louisiana has few legal protections for renters who can receive an eviction notice after withholding rent for any reason, even if that reason is a giant hole in the roof. At least 350 oil spills were reported in southeast Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico after Ida, according to reports. The days spent without electricity in the hot sun prompted more urgent calls for solar energy, an obvious solution for maintaining power for residents during a natural disaster. If more homes and businesses had solar panels connected to community microgrids and power banks, thousands of people could have kept refrigerators and air conditioners running, which can save lives during heat waves and other climate disasters. New Orleans residents are still clearing debris and repairing damaged homes after most of the city spent over a week without power. Many households emptied their refrigerators during the power outage, and the smell of garbage hangs in the summer air. Economic divide.
The fall of the U.S. dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there's a decline in the U.S. standing as a superpower, there's also the harsh reality that the U.S. is facing, the decline of the U.S. dollar. Hi, I'm Kavita Hawaii. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at whether the fall of the U.S. dollar is hyped or whether it is really happening, like a slow death for the U.S. Coming up in today's program, the share of the U.S. dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. What does that mean? Is that a move away from the dollar? That is a key question that we'll be looking at in this program. Another one of the highlights is how U.S. debt is playing a role in the decline of the dollar. There's a sovereign debt crisis that the U.S. is experiencing. Is that a reason for the dollar to collapse? We will examine the ways that that may be happening. And finally, we will take a look at something that the U.S. is using called dollar weaponization. The key instrument, sanctions. And the countries that are at the receiving end of it, at least some of them, are Iran, Russia, and China. Stay tuned. The dollar is king. That is the saying.
Well, the dollar is very strong. The country is very strong. The dollar is it's a beautiful thing in one way, but it makes it harder to compete. And despite that, but we have a very powerful dollar.
But it has been losing its value for quite some time. This new worry, COVID-19. Investors are worried the U.S. response is dealing a blow to the dollar, its status as the world's reserve currency declining.
With the recent gold price rally, and fueled by the ongoing and growing socioeconomic issues, the USD's position as the world's reserve currency might be threatened,
Investors and analysts, including billionaire hedge fund manager Ray Dalio and Goldman Sachs Group strategists, are warning that massive U.S. government spending in recent months could hurt the U.S. dollar. At the same time, rock-bottom U.S. interest rates for the foreseeable future and concerns over potential rise in inflation are denting the dollar's appeal.
What we've seen this go around is the need to distribute, to produce a lot of debt. Where did those checks come from? They came from the government. The government wrote the checks. But the government can't produce money. The central bank can produce money.
These factors are already weighing in on the dollar, which stands 9% below its high of the year and had its worst monthly performance in a decade for the month of July.
When there has to be a lot of selling of bonds, and bonds don't give any good return, there's a guaranteed negative return in bonds relative to inflation. And there's a pile of people who own bonds. And this isn't just Americans, but these are international investors owning bonds. And they have to buy a lot more bonds, because when the government has to sell a lot more debt, that means they have to buy a lot more bonds. There will not be enough demand for those bonds.
There's also the real issue about the economic policies of major governments of the world. The declining value of the U.S. dollar has come about because the investment community sees the U.S. government following a more expansive economic program than the other major governments.
It's a critical market. Let's face it, China's the world's second largest economy. It's one of the fastest growing major economies today. We've all seen some of the economic challenges of the world over the last 2 years with COVID and some of the struggles to recover from that. China was kind of first in and first out, and so has done recovered very quickly.
The U.S. dollar has been declining in value for quite some time. The key question is why. Also, we keep hearing about the fall of the dollar as the top currency of choice, but actual numbers prove otherwise. First, the fall. That is true. Since March 2020, its decline has moved steadily after the U.S. presidential elections. In the middle of July, July 15 to be exact, the WSJ dollar index was 90.57. Just before the election that happened on November 3, the index stood at 88.25. Then the decline in the value of the U.S. dollar picked up steam. Why did the U.S. start losing its value due to Biden's election win? Well, because the U.S. President Biden at this point has taken a more aggressive stance with respect to the economy. Just take a look at this $6 trillion budget plan. Now, this was proposed in May, which did not get fully approved, included the following: a $1.5 trillion request for operating expenditures for the Pentagon and other government departments. It also incorporated two plans that he had previously publicized: a $2.3 trillion jobs plan and a $1.8 trillion family plan. That's quite a lot, isn't it? And we're also going to cover how that affects the standing of the dollar. Well, joining us in the studio is our guest, Ahmad Salehi. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us. He is an economic analyst, and he has a specialty in the management of industrial projects. And this is his Twitter address, @AhmadSalehi _MEYMay. And also, he is active on Instagram, Ahmad.Salehi. Colin Official is his address on Instagram. So welcome. Obviously, our topic is the dollar, and my key question here is a general one. Why the U.S. dollar is used as a reserve currency? It's most often used in trade, given the fact that there are other currencies, and it still is the reserve currency of choice. I mean, the whole international financial system seems to be structured around the U.S. dollar. What's the reason? I mean, does the U.S. have a monopoly over it?
Yeah. My pleasure to be here.
Sure.
Actually, the whole thing is a matter of trust and a plain check that the world gave the United States in Bretton Woods. But what was the underlying foundation that gave the United States this power was the old cult myth that wars are good for the economy of the United States. You have to carefully study the history of the First and Second World War. Actually, when the world was in a war during both the world wars, the United States was providing the world with goods and material, but it was not getting currency, but gold. in compensation. So, during these two world wars, two-thirds of the gold reserves of the central banks was accumulated in Federal Reserve. So this was the first common foundation that gave the authority of the United States in Bretton Woods to actually dominate its dollar.
Okay, let's fast forward then. Thank you for that history check on that. Hopefully that answers a lot of questions regarding the dollar back then and its beginning. But we're going to take a look at two different vantage points in the way that the dollar is being covered. First, we're going to take a look at this graph. It says the IMF's new data shows that the share of the U.S. dollar reserves held by central banks fell to 59%. That is the lowest level in 25 years. And that happened during the fourth quarter of 2020. Mm-hmm. So it's very recent, pretty recent, actually. So that's one way that the dollar is being covered. Then you have this following clip and its take on how the dollar is doing right now.
Even as the coronavirus pandemic wreaked havoc across global markets, wiping out trillions of dollars worth of assets, the U.S. dollar was unaffected by the turmoil. At one point, it soared 4% against a basket of major currencies, namely the euro, pound, yen, Canadian dollar, Swiss franc, and Swedish krona.
So on the one hand, you have that in terms of the reserves falling to its lowest level in 25 years, and then you have what it said here, that during the pandemic, the dollar actually rose. And it actually gained strength against the other currencies in the basket.
Yes. Actually, we have to take a look at it from a wider span. There are reasons that the empire of dollar is dominant in the world. We can simplify it into four pillars. The first pillar is the trade of the energy, mainly oil, in the world, which is purely done by dollar. The second pillar is the IMF and the World Bank as the regulators of the fiscal and monetary policies throughout the world. And the third pillar is the WTO, which is the main function of WTO is spreading and increasing and promoting the global trade. And we know that the global trade is done via dollar. And the last, actually, pillar is the reserves, the currency reserves of the central banks. So if we want to have a better look at what is going on and what will be the future, we have to study carefully these four pillars. Of course, there are some internal factors also inside the United States economy. We're talking about the socio-economical parameters like the demographic of the population, the age of the population, which is getting older and older. But regardless of the internal factors of United States economy, when we look at these four pillars, we see that all of them are changing, not with a very rapid speed, but with a steady one.
We're going to have you back a little later on in the program, but for now, thank you very much for that, Ahmad Saleh. We do appreciate your comments, obviously very insightful there. So you heard some of the explanation that was given there by Ahmad Saleh. Our next piece is going to take a look at the U.S. dollar, but in terms of the debt that it has accumulated, how that plays into the picture, and obviously, with that comes the printing of the greenback, as you're about to find out.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. We are going to take a look at the U.S. dollar and why it's called a petrodollar. You may have heard the term, and how that is actually under threat. Now, the petrodollar, by definition, is any U.S. dollar that's paid to oil-exporting countries in exchange for oil. The dollar, as you know, is the preeminent global currency. That's how it's been. As a result, most international transactions, including oil, are priced in petrodollars. Now, oil-exporting nations actually receive dollars for their exports, but not in their own currency. Now, the question comes about in terms of how oil is pegged to the dollar and not to another currency. I mean, that's a viable question. Now, why that is, it's due to a 1945 U.S.-Saudi agreement which created the petrodollar. That's when it was born. What benefits comes from that, the petrodollar, for the U.S., that is? Well, it provides three immediate benefits: increasing global demand for U.S. dollars, increasing global demand for U.S. debt securities, and it also gives the U.S. this ability to buy oil with a currency that it can print at will. Think about that. That's a very important advantage that this brings for the United States. Now, most oil-exporting nations, such as Saudi Arabia and Iraq, for example, own their oil industries, and since they receive their payments in dollars, that makes their national income dependent on the dollar's value. So that means if the dollar falls, so does the government's revenue. Now, since they don't want to lose their payments value, most of these oil exporters have pegged their currencies to the dollar. And what does that do? Well, if the dollar value falls, so does the price of all of their domestic goods and services. Now, that helps these countries avoid wide swings in either inflation or deflation. Now, let's take a look at this question, how the dollar can actually be threatened. Well, just think about how oil is pegged to the dollar. All economies are oil-based. Pretty much a lot of things you see around you have some connection to oil in one way or another. So if there was a shift from oil to other renewable energy sources, that could threaten the petrodollar. So hopefully that makes sense to you. I mean, if you take a look at it, on the one hand, you have what's happening, the switch to renewable green energy, which threatens the dollar. And the other hand, you have countries which the dollar is shunned since it is being weaponized against them by the U.S. That's another point that needs to be considered here. Well, to explain this a little bit more for us, David Barkin, he's a professor of economics at the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana from Mexico, who joins us. He was a founding member of the Eco Development Center in 1974, for which he was awarded the National Prize in Political Economy. David, welcome. The dollar as a reserve currency falling out of favor with a number of countries like Russia, China, Iran, Pakistan, Nigeria, to name a few. Now, these countries have been on the receiving end of sanctions due to political fallouts that they've had with the U.S. What are the pros and cons in dumping a dollar in their bilateral trade?
Well, I think that the expression you use, dumping the dollar, is unfortunately not very relevant for many of those countries, because they're doing trade with international corporations, with private parties that are demanding payment in dollars for these transactions.
David Barkin there, and of course he made a great distinction. However, next up is going to be a report on how the U.S. actually uses the dollar as a weapon, the countries involved, but more so the focus being the process that it goes through in order to enforce its what's called sanctions regime.
The U.S. is weaponizing the dollar to keep its global standing.
it is convinced of an existential threat from competitors. It does this to maintain its global economic and geopolitical position. Others disagree with U.S.'s approach. The U.S. accounts for about 20% of the world's economic output, and more than half of all global currency reserves and trade is in dollars. This was the result of the 1944 Bretton Woods agreements, when each member agreed to redeem its currency for U.S. dollars, not gold.
So let me start with the debt cycle. You know, in 1945, we began a new world order. 1944, we created a new monetary system, the Bretton Woods monetary system. And then we created that new world order. And that created a bull markets in stocks and an American world order for the most part. There's a cycle that we're used to, in which whenever you have a economic downturn, the central bank hits the gas and can create debt expansion, and that produces an increase in demand.
The dollar's pivotal role allows the U.S. to easily finance its trade and budget deficits. It protects it against balance of payments crises because it imports its goods and services, borrowing in its own currency. U.S. monetary policies, like quantitative easing, can influence the value of the dollar. This gives the currency and the U.S. competitive advantage. The real power of the dollar, however, is its harsh sanctions program. This is the consultation process to enforce the sanctions. When all of these departments are combined, they provide the force needed to go after the worldwide monetary financial system known as SWIFT, or the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications Business. When combined with access that it gained to data from SWIFT, the U.S. exerts unprecedented control over global economic activity. U.S. sanctions target people, entities, officials, or even an entire country. There's no denying it. Some major economies are dumping the dollar or drawing down the reserves of the dollar. Actually, those are two separate issues, as our guests have indicated. Now, the countries we can mention here are China, Russia, and Iran, but what if the outcome of this is for the U.S. to actually threaten military action against them? Now, this was mentioned in an opinion piece written by Shannon Abraham. She said in order to avert a sudden dollar collapse, the U.S. has taken robust measures in the past to avoid this, and went as far as militarily, that is, threatening to attack or attacking other countries that are dumping the dollar. Some examples, the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, or former President Saddam Hussein, announcing that Iraq would no longer sell its U.S. or its oil in the U.S. dollars. That's one example. We can take a look at Libya. In 2011, NATO to have attacked it in order to thwart the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, to create a gold-backed African currency in dinars, if you remember that. He also pushed African and Middle Eastern governments to dump the dollar. All right, our in-house guest joins us, Ahmad Salih, rejoins us for his final comments. We also have David Barkin, economist, also rejoining us. Okay, Ahmad, so the final question here, this theory that I just talked about, countries that are dumping the dollar from the trade where they want to eliminate the dollar, it seems like there is this relationship or connection being made that they are being targeted by the U.S. Militarily, perhaps, or that being actually the focus, Syria, Libya, Iraq, Iran being threatened by the U.S. on a number of occasions, and Russia and China also high on the radar of the U.S. Do you agree that in order to avert a sudden dollar collapse, the U.S. has taken these types of measures which involve militarily attacking the countries?
Yes, it's very interesting, and you came up with some examples. If you study the nuclear dossier of Iran, during the 12 months before these two sanctions being applied, there was no major incident happening on the ground in terms of the nuclear activities. If you go study in the history, you see that there is nothing done previously when Iran was doing, for example, the 20% enrichment. There was a new sanction being applied by United Nations or Security Council. But the 12 months prior to the crippling sanctions of the central bank cut off from the SWIFT and the oil, there was absolutely no activity on the ground with regard to the nuclear dossier. But Ahmadinejad stepped into a very new dangerous path, and that was ditching the dollar. like the same as Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein did.
Let me turn our attention now to David. David, you heard our guest there, and you know, we're looking at the countries that are dumping the dollar at this point from the trade, and there's an association being made that they are being militarily perhaps targeted by the U.S., which in the past we can talk about Syria, Libya, and Iraq, all attacked by the U.S., of course, Libya through NATO. And then you have countries like Russia and China and Iran who are being threatened by the U.S. Do you think that there's a correlation there, that the U.S. actually targets these countries militarily?
I'm not sure that the United States' use of military force or the threat of military force against these countries that you mentioned is the result of these countries dumping the dollar per se, as much as these countries trying to develop their own internal development strategies, trying to develop a reasonable path for internal stability and well-being.
All right, David Barkin there. Unfortunately, we just don't have any more time to continue this discussion. I'm sure we're going to have you back, but thank you very much, Ahmad.
Just one point.
Sure. Go ahead.
About the JFK, I was talking about the executive order 11110. That was a very important executive order by U.S. President, and this order was empowering the U.S. Treasury to issue real note. We were talking about issuing real dollar for the first time and for the last time in history, parallel to Federal Reserve. So he had a plan, because as you know, Federal Reserve is the only central bank which is a private entity.
Right, exactly.
So it was the
not many people know
Kennedy.
That, actually.
Yeah.
It's not common
It was the Kennedy's plan to take the power from the private sector of the so-called bankers or Illuminatis and to give it to the nation of the United States. We are talking about the government.
Thank you for that. Very insightful. We appreciate it. Ahmad Salehi, political economic analyst. Let me mention again your Twitter address, @AhmadSalehi_May, and also at Instagram, Ahmad.Salehi.official. Thank you for your contribution to the program.
Thank you, too.
The story of the dollar decline has been around for over a decade. There is no question that the decline is happening. As long as oil is pegged to the dollar will retain its strength in one way or another. But not so fast. The U.S. has single-handedly led itself down the path of the dollar decline. Massive spending, enormous printing of the dollar, well, those factors have accelerated the decline. And by weaponizing the dollar, many countries have shied away from it. By the way, COVID-19 may be the last straw. With a strong yuan, the dollar will literally have a run for the money. That does it for this edition of the program. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Yikove Tahwei and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.